Let's talk about the muscles in your body that you use all the time. Even if you walk a lot, can you imagine flexing a leg muscle every second of every day for your entire life? Let's move up and in then and consider the heart. It starts beating before we're born and continues to move blood through the body until we die. That is one tough muscle, and we obviously attach more importance to the heart, especially around Valentine's Day. Bill Shutt considers all of this in his new book, Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. Bill Shutt is a professor of biology at LIU Post, the Long Island University branch that is not in Brooklyn, but on Long Island's North Shore. Bill Shutt wrote or co-wrote five previous books, including Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, which brought him to the Jefferson Exchange in February of 2017. So, Bill Shutt, welcome back.
It's really nice to be here, Jeff.
So we're talking body parts again, but not necessarily as food this time. And you start off with the story of a blue whale heart. This is a really fascinating accidental arrival.
Yeah. In 2014, there was sort of a tragedy in Newfoundland off the coast. Nine blue whales died, and we believe that they were stuck on ice floe. And my friends, who were curators at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, were specialists in whales, and they had been getting these questions for years about what's the largest heart in the world, and they'd say, well, it's the blue whale heart. How big is it? Oh, it's the size of a sedan. But they really didn't know, because blue whales have a tendency, when they die, to sink, which during the whaling times made them the wrong whales as opposed to the right whales, which floated when you threw a harpoon at them.
I never realized that's why they were called right whales in the first place.
Yeah.
There's one thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, for me, the whole book was really a learning experience, very steep learning curve. But there were just so many things that are related to the heart that I had no idea about. But to make a long story short, they found out that three of these whales actually washed up. We think that they were supported by some of the floating ice. And so they sent a crew, and we're talking about construction equipment, 10 different folks, and it took them days, but they were able to get inside this whale. So you've got four guys inside a blue whale pushing the heart out after they've severed it through the ribs that they'd spread. And when they got the thing out, and it's lying on the beach, and this is in this small village in Newfoundland, it, to me, when I saw pictures of it, it didn't look like a heart. It looked like a 400-pound soup dumpling. And so this really started this cascade of things about this heart, which is a mammalian heart. And so you figure we know a lot about it. But there were just so many things about it that the researchers didn't know. So they were able to get this thing packed away, and then they had to store it, put it on ice for a year, then rinse it, then preserve it. And I talk about the fact that in science classes, we're afraid of, when we spill formaldehyde on ourselves, we get all twisted up. But here these guys were using thousands of gallons of formalin to preserve this heart before they could do anything else with it. So they were worried about falling into a vat of this stuff rather than splashing a little bit on them. So after it was preserved, they sent it over to Germany, and it underwent a process called plastination. If you've seen the Bodies Live exhibit where, here's a guy bouncing a basketball, but he's got no skin, and his, the muscle has all been turned to plastic. Yeah, that's what they did in Germany at this plastinarium. And what came back was this incredible, and this is after 5 years, incredible heart specimen. And so they had had an exhibition based around it, but as I said, there were some big surprises. One of them was how small it was. This was a real surprise to them, because they thought that they were going to have an SUV sitting next to this thing to compare size. And in reality, it could have been a golf cart. And so the questions mounted. It was like, why is it so small? And the idea here, what they believe is that, if you were to have a hummingbird that weighed 90 tons and you sat it next to this whale, it would have a heart that was 8 times the size of that blue whale heart. And we think that's because hummingbird hearts beat 80 times per second. And in order to supply blood to those muscles, you've got to speed up the heart rate. And they've got a heart rate of 1,260 beats per minute. That's ridiculous. And we think that might be just about the top limit that a heart can beat. If you think of a heart as a machine, it can only beat so fast. That might be it. So the only other way to get blood to the wing muscles is to have a larger heart. So animals like hummingbirds, with their high metabolic rate and their requirement for large amounts of oxygen and energy, have a much larger heart relative to a blue whale, whose heart may be beating 10, 15 times a minute, and then when they deep dive, which is why we think their heart looked like a soup dumpling, the heart completely collapses and only beats 2 or 3 times a minute. So, I mean, it went on and on. There were blood vessels that they had no idea what they were doing.
How did you not write the book just on the blue whale heart?
Yeah. Well, my friends at the ROM thought I should, and I could have. But there was just so much. There were so many instances in the animal kingdom where what I thought, I didn't want to write an encyclopedia, but I wanted to write a book where I covered the really intriguing aspects of what hearts and circulatory systems are, and it turned out that many of the animals that I picked turned out not only to have super interesting circulatory systems and hearts, but were also tied into research that was being done in fields of medicine to improve our knowledge about the human heart and its treatment. So, I studied vampire bats for 30 years, and I'd like to have a dollar for every time somebody said something along the lines of, you study these animals for so long, but how does that keep my grandmother alive for another year or two? And that's, I had that in mind when I started to come across all of these examples of animals, like the zebrafish in a fish tank, or the pythons that are now invading the Everglades, and their aspects of their circulatory system are being used to improve our knowledge about the human heart.
Yeah, we have learned a lot. You learn a lot in the book about the other creatures, and it helps you understand what goes on with our heart and our circulatory and respiratory systems as well. We'll come back and talk more with Bill Shutt. His book is Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. And we're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest is Bill Shutt, professor of biology at LIU Post at Long Island University. Once again, his latest book is called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. And I'm sure it's got the physiology and the biology, but also some of the philosophy and the ways we've thought about the heart as an organ that contains the soul, for example. Well, it doesn't, it turns out, but we'll learn a lot about the heart, not just in humans, but in other creatures as well. And you're welcome to join our conversation here on The Exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You write about some of the structural complications in describing what you're writing about in the book, and you point out that in a lot of textbooks, the respiratory and circulatory systems are often in different chapters. Why do you advocate for them to be together?
Yeah, I always tell my students that thinking about organ systems as being separate entities, and you've got three lectures on the circulatory system, and then they take an exam, and I tell them you can't just sort of do that and then forget that material before you get out to your car, because you cannot understand the circulatory system without the respiratory system, and by the same token, you can't understand the circulatory system without the nervous system. And so this is just, unfortunately, that's the way that textbooks are set up, but that's just not the way that the body works, and that there is this intricate interplay between these systems that really needs to be emphasized as much as memorizing what these structures are.
Well, and there's stuff in the blood, obviously, that plays roles in the fact that we take in oxygen or take in all kinds of other gases and go for the oxygen. But interesting, I didn't realize our hemoglobin-rich blood has a weakness. It's attracted to carbon dioxide?
Yeah, carbon monoxide, which is why I sort of stopped the book and just go, listen, if you don't have a carbon monoxide detector, or you know somebody who's a relative who doesn't have one, then put the book down for right now and go get one, and I'll see you in a bit. And the reason is that hemoglobin, which is found in red blood cells, is the pigment based molecule that carries oxygen around the body. It picks it up in the lungs, and then carries it and drops it off in tissues. Now that works really well, and the problem is that when you come into contact with carbon monoxide, not carbon dioxide. So if you're in a place that's, you know, if you have a heater that's on a gas heater and it's running inside and fumes are getting in, or you leave you start your car up in the garage with the door closed, these engines produce carbon monoxide, and carbon monoxide is more greatly attracted to hemoglobin than oxygen is, which is why it's so dangerous in very small amounts. And so, you know, I'm not writing a textbook here, but there are all of these places where I like to get in there and insert information in a way that is, you know, that you might repeat over at the dinner table, and rather than have it come out of some textbook that you might have breezed through 10 years earlier in an intro bio class. So I've been lucky in that regard that I'm able to go through and, you know, in this instance, I'm telling people, just watch out about eating breakfast before you go out to shovel snow. Why? Well, because the blood is being diverted to your digestive tract so that you can break down your Cheerios, and it's not going to places like your heart via the coronary arteries. So if you go out and exercise by moving a ton of snow, you're really putting a stress on the heart that might be problematic. So these are the types of things that I think are important.
All right, yeah, and carbon monoxide detectors are pretty cheaply gotten. We have one, and I was handling it yesterday, in fact, as we were getting the ready to fire up the gas fireplace for the winter. Back to the point about exercising after eating, I remember that part of it, but is it more specific to cold weather?
Yeah, especially during cold weather. That's not to say that somebody who has a heart problem should go out and exercise, you know, and run a marathon, because that's just not, you know, I don't want to get that point across as well. But our body has these has reactions to cold weather, and if you mess it up by diverting blood to where it generally doesn't go when you're cold, which is the digestive tract, you know, it's this whole story of the autonomic nervous system. This is the part of your nervous system that deals with stuff that you have no control over. It speeds up heart rate and blood pressure and respiratory rate, and then when there's not this stress, it mellows it out and lowers those measurements. So it's a matter of your body thinks one thing's going on. Oh, it's rest and repose time. We can send blood to your intestines and stomach, but you're telling it, no, I'm going outside to shovel all of this snow, and that can lead to problems because the blood has, in a sense, been diverted.
All right, so we're talking to Bill Shutt here in the Jefferson Exchange about his latest book, Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. And a lot of creatures in here, horseshoe crabs. We talked to the folks who wrote Crab Wars recently. Let's go to actual horses, though. I mean, it's interesting here because the horse's liver is involved in respiration and circulation.
Yeah, that was, you know, I'm trying to explain the fact that that there are organs that assist us in ways that we don't, that we just don't know about. And the one that I remembered from graduate school was the fact that here you have a horse that's running, and as it's striding back and forth, its guts are moving back and forth, you know, with the stride. And so the liver, which is huge, is moving forward as the animal strides forward and pushing on the diaphragm. And the diaphragm is compressing the thoracic cavity where the lungs are, and assisting in emptying the lungs. So then when the liver moves back in the opposite direction, it pulls on the diaphragm because it's attached to it. And so that assists, so that increases the volume of the cavity that the lungs are in, and that enables the lungs to fill easier. You know, it was just a, you know, it was a section that had sort of a tie-in to to the circulatory system, but I was getting across the idea that in horseshoe crabs, their gills, their movement of their gills helps to circulate blood. And you know, to me, that was, you know, the example that with this visceral pump in horses was something that, my wonderful artist friend Patricia Wynn could illustrate, and that would get this point across.
A lot of illustrations in the book, yes, and all helpful. But you know, but the chapter titles alone pull me in. I mean, there's one that starts with Mothra the movie monster. Why does Mothra make it into this book?
Mothra makes it into this book because if you look at insect circulatory systems, they do not carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. So there's no tie-in. Just like in us, it's extremely important that connection. In insects, no. Insect blood, which is called hemolymph, because it doesn't carry oxygen and carbon dioxide, it just carries nutrients and waste. So how do they get their air, their oxygen? And that's through little holes in the side of their body called spiracles. And so you can envision the hole on the side of the body that opens to a tube, and that tube splits off into smaller and smaller and smaller tubes until it reaches the point where it's in contact with cells. So the air just moves in through those tubes and eventually the oxygen gets to the cells and tissues. Now that works great if you're really small, but it doesn't work well if you're a moth the size of a zeppelin. So this is just my point that, you know, this is a creature that could not exist if it has a typical insect respiratory system.
All right, but the system's then very different, you know. So some animals don't have hearts per se. You know, some, I remember earthworms, as you point out in the book, from sixth grade, and aortic arches. I mean, but you caution scientists and students not to think of any system as superior to any other. It sounds like they're really just what works for that animal.
Yes, exactly right. You know, we have this sort of tendency, some of us, to look at the organs that humans have and think, well, this is, you know, this is the ultimate in evolution. And I try to get my readers and my students to not think like that, because these, you know, whether you're looking at the aortic arches of an earthworm or the open circulatory system of an insect, which means that the blood doesn't remain inside the circulatory system, it sort of dumps out into these cavities.
It bastes the organs, you know, in essence, right?
Yeah, but these things have been evolving for millions and millions of years, and they work perfectly fine for what they're being asked to do. So it's sort of, I think we're doing a disservice to think of them as somehow ineffective or defective. You know, I just remember growing up and seeing, whenever you saw a picture of like a Neanderthal, he was hunched over, he was dragging his woman around by the hair, and he had a club. You know, and we know that none of that is true. They're hunched over because the first fossil Neanderthals had really bad arthritis. And so when they put the skeletons together, they looked like they were hunched over. Now we know that their brains were larger than the brain of a modern human. So I'm just trying to keep, you know, trying to teach my readers and let them know that, you know, just because we've got this complex heart doesn't necessarily make it better. In fact, the more complex the structure, the more apt it is to have problems.
So we are talking about the heart with Bill Schutt, a professor of biology at LIU Post on Long Island. His latest book is called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Everything you always wanted to know about hearts in humans and the way we think about the heart, you're welcome to join the conversation at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, here's another great example animal, giraffes. How do they keep the flood blowing to the blood flowing to their brains when they're so far up there?
Yeah, great question. We'll start out with blood pressure. Our blood pressure is roughly around 120 over 80 is average. That means when the heart is contracting, that top number 120, that's the pressure measurement. And then when it relaxes, that's the lower number 80. If you look at a giraffe blood pressure, it's 280 over 180. So it has the highest blood pressure of any mammal, and it has that. It's evolved that because you've got to be able to pump that blood against gravity up 8-12 feet up to the brain. The heart is huge. It's if you looked at a giraffe heart, it's like 2 feet across, and so there were all of these these other adaptations that evolve to deal with the fact that you've got this tremendously tall animal. And what happens when it lowers its head to drink? Why doesn't the blood that's returning to the heart from the brain, the venous blood, why doesn't that back up and pool in brain? And the reason is because there are valves that in the jugular vein that prevent that backflow. You know, you can look at the legs and say, well, what about the blood that is super powered, that by not only having a high blood pressure, but by gravity to get to the feet? When this blood is moving to the feet, it can be well over 300 millimeters of mercury. So why doesn't it blow out those little capillaries? And it's really the same idea that we've stolen, and when we put pressure socks on. And you put pressure socks on so that you don't get edema, which is, if you have high blood pressure, there's a tendency for the liquid in the blood to leave the capillaries and seep out and accumulate in the tissue. And that's what edema is. And so this is prevented by wearing, you know, pressure socks, pressure stockings. And by the same token, a giraffe leg, giraffe legs have really, really tight skin. And that prevents the loss of fluid in those limbs because of the high pressure that they're under.
Wow, that's a pretty good design all around. So on the other end of the BP spectrum, the blood pressure spectrum, how low does it get in hagfish?
yeah, slime eels.
I was going to ask you the other names. There we go.
Yes, and you guys have got them on the West Coast. We don't have them over here, which is unfortunate. I goof around about how you fish for these things.
We had an accident a couple of years ago on the Oregon Coast Highway, and these vats of slime eels ended up on the road. It was quite the sight.
Oh my God! How on earth did they remove it? That must have been insane.
I don't remember. Yikes.
Well, in any event, they are sort of they're the anti hummingbird. They've got a blood pressure, or the anti giraffe. They've got a blood pressure somewhere around 6 to 10 millimeters per mercury, and so they are a really low pressure system. So these are animals that are not really active, and they're really they're really the stars as far as the extreme end of the spectrum with regard to blood pressure. They just kind of, you know, they eat the dead, as you know, they sort of burrow in. If you want to catch one of these things, you take a dead cow and you lower it down on a rope and then come back a week later and pull the rope up and split the cow open, and here are the hagfish. So it doesn't really have a super active lifestyle, and that enables it to get by with that type of an extremely low-powered circulatory system.
Is it fair to say that as weight and complexity of an animal increase, the heart follows?
Close, yeah. The thing is that, you know, there are animals there are creatures that don't need a circulatory system because they're so small or so flat that they, you know, they get their oxygen by, it just diffuses from the environment, a high concentration in the water that they happen to be in, and the carbon dioxide and waste that starts to be produced, that does the same thing. It moves from inside the cell just out into the environment following that concentration gradient from high to low. But once you get bigger, once you get larger, once you get hundreds and thousands and millions of cells, then you needed a system that was going to be able to move that a liquid around that could cart around the oxygen and carbon dioxide and waste material and nutrients. And that's what circulatory systems are. So there's this huge variation, especially in the animals that are invertebrates, that without a backbone. And we think that's because these pumps and their vasculature evolved many times. When you move to the vertebrates, the backboned animals, there is similarity whether you're looking at fish or amphibians or reptiles, mammals, and birds, because we believe that circulatory systems in the vertebrate creatures evolved once. So, you know, there were differences in the number of chambers, mm-hmm. and there are certainly some serious differences in the biology of the blood, for example. But there's a real similarity in most aspects of vertebrate systems.
Yeah, you can certainly find analogous structures in them. And there's some interesting systems that look like workarounds. Like you show us pictures of fish with just one ventricle and one atrium, but they also have stretchy blood vessels that act like the muscles in a heart.
Oh yeah, and just like, you know, we have our aorta is a stretchy vessel. You know, it stretches, and it's like so it stretches and stores energy as it fills, and then it snaps back and sends the blood on its way. So that's an assist to the heart. So when you hear the term hardening of the arteries, that's problematic when that large vessel, the aorta, won't do that anymore.
Let's come back to animals in the cold. We talked about humans and not going out to shovel right after you've had breakfast, shovel the snow. Not that it happens much around here, but I remember Long Island. Yeah, that gets serious. But some frogs just freeze solid and then thaw out?
Yeah, northern wood frog. So a lot of creatures cope with as I go into in the book, a lot of creatures cope with cold in various ways. You know, they either move or they hibernate. They slow down their metabolic rate, like bears, for example, and bats. But then there are some creatures that just they go with the flow, and that their entire body freezes. And and when you think about that, you know, when I started to get into this, because when I was a kid, it was, you know, Walt Disney had died, and there was this rumor that was going around that Walt Disney's body was kept cryogenically preserved underneath the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, and so I started to think about cryogenics, and the animal that popped out was this northern wood frog, which allows itself to freeze solid over the winter. And so if that were a human, for example, or most any other type of animal, when ice forms inside the body, inside tissues, inside cells, it tears them up because the ice crystals are jagged. Mm-hmm. So how does this creature get around that? And what happens is that, to make a long story short, they release large amounts of glucose right before they're about to cool down. And this glucose allows water to leave the tissues and cells. So the water leaves the tissues and cells, sort of dehydrating it, and accumulates in their body cavity.
Wow.
So when I was working with the
Bill, hang on a second. We're almost on the break here. We'll pick it up on the other side. Pump, A Natural History of the Heart by Bill Shutt on the Jefferson Exchange. Back in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We have Bill Shutt with us once again, a professor of biology at LIU Post on Long Island. It's part of Long Island University. He's back with another book, not about cannibalism this time, but about the heart, not just in humans. It's called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. You can join our conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I was thinking about the wood frog and the glucose driving the water out. Essentially, it's putting antifreeze in the pipes for the winter.
Yeah, and there are animals that have real antifreeze, but this sort of works in a different way than that. You know, and so I do go into some of the creatures like the Antarctic ice fish that do have antifreeze compounds. But if you have an antifreeze in your circulatory system, you're trying to lower the temperature at which everything will freeze, and that's just not the case here. Everything is freezing, and it's really the opposite. You want to move the liquid out of the tissue into a place where it's not going to damage things when it freezes, and that's why it accumulates in the abdominal cavity. But no, this thing freezes solid.
Wow, that's just amazing.
Yeah.
But is there any other creature that we know of on the Earth that does it?
Now, there are probably other amphibians, but especially when I'd be looking in places like, in Canada or, mm-hmm. or places where it gets cold and where you do have amphibians, you know, so I'd be looking in those types of areas.
You mentioned the fish that have antifreeze in the blood. Those are generally in the mm-hmm. Antarctic. And those antifreeze-like compounds created in their bodies, it's not something they eat or something, is it?
Oh, no, they're proteins. Oh. And it's so, I mean, they're incredibly strange as well. And I, as I said, I went through a bunch of animals that had medical applications to them. And so these antifreeze compounds that they've isolated in the Antarctic ice fish are being used to do things like when you're transporting organs and it's got to move from one side of the country to the other to be transplanted into somebody. They're experimenting with ways to use these antifreeze compounds to keep the tissues and the organs from being damaged during transport. But beyond that, I had to laugh because the main use for these antifreeze compounds is that ice cream companies are using them. You ever have ice cream and you finish half of it and then you put it in the freezer and when you take it back out, it's all crunchy. It's got that
frosty
crystals.
Stuff on top. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're using these very antifreeze compounds found in ice fish to prevent large crystals from forming. So the proteins attach themselves to the small crystals, and they don't allow the ice crystals to get large. So they're really being used to improve mouthfeel in refrozen ice cream.
But well, that's a great medical use, huh?
Yeah. Well, thankfully there were a bunch of other animals where there are these incredible medical uses for their biology.
Well, you know, since we started talking about the Antarctic fish, let's continue on with fish. You mentioned zebra fish briefly earlier. We have talked to researchers, particularly the University of Oregon, who keep a lot of them around for a lot of different kinds of experiments. So
sure.
talk about why zebra fish are so good for experiments with things that affect humans.
Well, they probably are like 70% genetically similar to us. So that's the reason why they are, and they are easy to breed, they're easy to maintain. But as far as cardiac research, here's a real problem, is that if you were to get a blockage, let's say, and I'm talking about a coronary artery. So a coronary artery is temporarily blocked. So the tissue downstream that is not being supplied by blood anymore may die. And even if you restart the circulation and you get rid of the blockage, that tissue that had been downstream and damaged does not grow back into functional cardiac muscle tissue. So in a sense, what's left there is scar tissue in the heart. Now, if you look at the zebrafish, you can remove, and you got to figure this came from, this was a selection because of predators. If a predator takes a bite out of a zebrafish and it loses 20% of its heart mass, or if a researcher comes along and snips it off, that heart grows back completely and completely functional.
Wow.
So what is it about zebrafish hearts that allows them to repair themselves in a way that the human heart cannot? So that was, to me, just a spectacular example of people looking at the animal kingdom and trying to come up with improvements for cardiac medicine.
And you also mentioned earlier on the Burmese python, this invasive species that's gotten loose in the Everglades, and it's got a value to us for research about human hearts.
Yeah, and this was this came completely out of the blue to me. There's a Dr. Leslie Leanwand, who works at the University of Colorado, has been working on Burmese pythons. And these are, as you said, invasive species, and there are estimates that there are over a million of them now in the Everglades, and they eat everything. So populations of native animals is just dropping through the floor.
There are no
because
mammals
of these
left,
massive,
pretty much, right?
Excuse me?
No mammals left, pretty much, in the Everglades.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a real problem. So she looked at these and realized that after a meal, which is these animals eat these, you know, large animals that they consume, that their heart grows 40% in size. Now, when we think about enlarged heart, we think negative. And this is not that type of heart growth. This is healthy heart tissue. So she's trying to figure out what is it in the blood of these pythons that allows for healthy heart growth seemingly without any type of exercise. And the bottom line here is that if you, let's say you had a heart problem and they put you on an exercise regime to strengthen your heart, that's the sort of tried and true method to do this. Now, there are some people who cannot exercise after having a heart problem. And how do you strengthen and improve and possibly grow the heart in these folks who can't go on these exercise regimens? So that's the kinds of questions that she's asking.
Let's take the story of the heart back in time now, because obviously we've been having a lot of different thoughts about it as humans through the time that we've been humans. Why, for example, did Egyptians bury the heart and the other organs separate from the body?
Yeah, when I started to look into this, I thought back to my book on cannibalism, and I thought, you know, I was thinking, why do you have this knee-jerk reaction every time you mention the word cannibalism? And I was going to name the chapter "Blame It on the Greeks." Mm. And so when I started to look back at questions like why do we have this connection between the heart and emotion and the soul and intellect and memory? Where did that come from? I could have named the chapter "Blame It on the Ancient Egyptians." now these were researchers and scientists back then who may have gotten some things really right, and that was, you know, that they may have been able to detect aneurysms, they may have been able to detect heart attacks and characterize them. Kind of difficult to figure out with the translations from papyrus, but they really valued the heart, and that's probably because they saw that it moved, it responded to stimuli just like a living thing would do, and it was sort of centrally located, and so they ascribed to the heart all of these different all of the things that I just mentioned, the term for that would be cardiocentric, where everything is based on the heart. Now the problem is, and the problem is, they got a lot wrong. They, for example, thought that the arterial side of the circulatory system carried air, and their information, the Egyptian medical information, was held in really high esteem by the Greeks. The ancient Greeks picked that up and ran with it, that idea of cardiocentrism. Now, meanwhile, artists, poets, are jumping on the bandwagon and thinking this is where the heart. This is the importance of the heart, and from there it moved on to the Romans, and that idea carried on and on. And unfortunately, medical science ran into a wall after Galen, who was a Roman surgeon. He wrote like 3 million words. A lot of what he wrote was wrong, and he had picked that up from the ancient Greeks, who had picked it up from the Egyptians, and so the problem was that. 3 million words that were never translated initially into Latin, and they were translated decades and decades later by Syrian Christians into Arabic. And it wasn't until the sort of Middle Ages that the Arabic version of Galen's work was translated into Latin. And at that point, it had this Christian slant to it, and the church loved that. And so from then on, Galen's work became divinely inspired. You don't even ask to do research, don't ask questions, just follow Galen by rote. And so the medical field stagnated for 1,500 years.
Wow, that's really amazing. And the fact is, as you point out in the book, the idea that the heart was not the end-all, be-all, actually came a lot earlier than you might think. The idea of craniocentrism arose a long time ago.
Yeah, it did, but it was, you know, we're talking about places like the Middle East and possibly some of it in India and China, but I mean, a lot of that stuff was stifled, and in the West they just didn't want to hear about that. And it wasn't until the 17th century that we moved away from the idea of balancing the four humors and the idea that the circulatory systems were separate, and that blood, venous blood, came from the liver, and arterial blood was mixed with this sort of spirit substance that was floating around in the air. So, but it did take a long, long time.
Well, and then all that stuff we did wrong for so long, like using leeches and bleeding people, and I hadn't seen the figure before that George Washington's death was greatly contributed to by the doctors who took about 40% of his blood out.
Oh yeah, and because he had a throat infection, mm-hmm. and so when I looked at this, I thought to myself, well, if I go back and go to the sources, I can figure out when they had a follow up, an inquiry about after he died. This is arguably the most famous person in the world at the time. You know, how did this happen? Who screwed up? And what I found was that, you know, instead, like you said, they bled 40% of his blood out, and he probably went into a hemorrhagic coma and died the next day. But I thought to myself, okay, so now here's this inquest. We're going to find out what happened here. In reality, what I read was they would say things like, oh, no, they did screw. They messed us up badly. They should have bled him closer to his throat, or, you know, they should have packed his feet with salt or give him another enema. And I just went, these are the top physicians at the time, and this is what they were following. This is what they were doing. You know, so it really wasn't a matter of, you know, that these guys wandered into onto the plantation and messed up. They were doing what they were taught to do, and it's unfortunate. And this type of thing carried on. You know, if it was 100 years later, instead of bleeding him, they would have just attached leeches to him. Oh, but it would have been the same thing.
So we got about 2 minutes left to cover the fact that Darwin does appear in the book, not surprisingly, but he appears as a medical patient. Why?
Yeah, there's some controversy. I mean, Darwin, when he came back in 1836 from the voyage around the world on the Beagle, was chronically ill for the rest of his life, and he had this like long laundry list of things that that were wrong with him, and so there has been all sorts of speculation about what it is that he had, one of the things that is a possibility now is that he had described in his journals being bit by a something called a kissing bug or an assassin bug, and this is a creepy little thing that defecates on you while it's drawing blood out of you, and then you wipe at the wound and you wipe it into something like your eye or your mouth, and from there the feces of this that's in this insect has this bacterium in it that causes what we now know to be Chagas disease. And so there is speculation and some evidence that because of the symptoms that Darwin showed over for the rest of his life, that he may have actually had Chagas disease, that they wouldn't allow a tissue sample from Westminster Abbey. So this is all just sort of like a hypothesis, and I don't think they'll ever be able to prove it.
Wow. So, of all the hearts that you looked at in the book, Bill, was there one animal's circulatory system that you found weirder than any others?
Oh, weird circulatory systems. Yeah. Well, so squid, for example. Mm-hmm. So here's an invertebrate, right? This is something like a worm or insect, but it has three hearts. It's got two hearts that pump blood to its gills, and another heart that pumps that blood that comes out of the gills to the body. And we think that this high-tech circulatory system evolved because of the activity that these animals exhibit, and they are very, very intelligent as well. So they're super fast, and they're really, you know, they're active all the time. So in order to be able to be this super fast, very smart predator, they've got a... they've got this high-powered circulatory system in three different hearts.
Wow. Pump and natural history.
No, that was a neat one.
All right, Bill Shutt, thanks so much for joining us again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Pleasure to be here.